all love, for me, it comes from self-love. And how do you create self-love? For me, I create self-love, number one, by going through and being true to my word, not only to other people, but to myself. I realize, you know, greatness is unlocked if you usually can just do what you say you're going to do.
All right, everyone, welcome back or welcome to the Live Unbound podcast. This is a space where we explore the stories, secrets, and skills of the world's top performers, coming from diverse industries, including business, sports, entertainment, the military, arts, adventure, and much more. I'm Steve McDonald, your host and high performance consultant. All right, guys. So Dan Nitro Clark is an inspiring person for many reasons. And he is somebody that has been at the heights of fame, somebody that has been, you know, knocking on death's door in reality through a heart attack. He has been somebody that has dealt with significant trauma, and he is somebody that has given back to the world through his character and his many philanthropic activities, and an all-round good person doing good things with a good mission, and much more. So I was really honored to speak with Dan, and you know, we explored a lot of things. So, you know, he, as I mentioned, dealt with a lot of trauma. He had to, you know, navigate being at the heights of fame and stardom with the American hit show Gladiators, and how he was able to deal with that, I suppose, deal with the fame, deal with the notoriety, and be able to, I suppose, live a life beyond Nitro, beyond the Gladiator, beyond the love and adoration for that person, you know, and leaving that person behind, ultimately transition into everyday life. He practices gratitude quite a lot. It's key to his overall spiritual practice and well-being. And obviously gratitude is such a huge part of, you know, our ability to be well in life, is to be grateful. So, you know, it's easier said than done. So I think Dan done a good job. He actually practiced it on the call with me. So I was very grateful to be able to actually experience the practice that he uses. So hopefully you learn from that as well. Big boys don't cry, but men do. Dan had to figure that one out the hard way. And I think for every person, every man, you know, listening in here today, there's a message in this episode that, you know, you need to listen to. And being kind, right? So look, we had a great conversation, and I suppose you can sense, hopefully, from my voice how inspired I am from Dan. And I think I just want to hand it over now, guys, and feel free to share this with anybody you feel that would benefit from it. So, yeah, hope you enjoy, guys, and thank you once more for tuning in.
All right, Dan, listen, man, thank you so much for giving me the space, giving us the time. Really appreciate it. Like, you know, I know you're a man in demand, right? So good to have you here, brother. So Dan, tell us more about, like, it's been a wild ride for you, hasn't it? Your life, been a wild ride.
Well, I think everyone's life, Stephen's a wild ride, you know, and it just comes down to, have you prepared yourself and put yourself in a place to handle it when the flat tire comes, your car goes screeching off the road? Have you put yourself in a place with your preparation to be able to handle the ride? Because the one thing we know about life is that it's full of chaos. And those who can remain calm and make the best decisions during those chaotic moments, those moments of tragedy, and turn them to triumph, those happen to be the people, I believe, who succeed.
Yeah. Dan, like, there's a lot to unpack, right? So one of the exercises I do when I work with teams is just a very simple exercise where you kind of get people, you strengthen the connection between people, and you get them closer to each other by the people stepping into who they are as humans, and their selves, you know, their authenticity. But you need to be vulnerable to do that, right? So there's an exercise I'll share with you, right? And I'd love for you to, I suppose, answer the questions that I'm going to ask from that place, right? So it's Triple H. You probably know the wrestler Triple H, previous wrestler Triple H, right? But it's an acronym for Highlight Hardship Hero. So when you reflect back on your life, Dan, right? So from, you know, your journey to now, right? From zero to where you are right now in life. Like, what's been the biggest highlight in your life, right? What's your gut saying is, fuck me, that's something I'm, you know, that's really the must. powerful moment in my life. That's the biggest highlight.
Let me preface this before any highlight I've had in the real actual physical world, I've almost always had that highlight in my head first. Mm-hmm. I'm a big believer in creative visualization, seeing the future that you want, building the neural connections by seeing yourself in those situations before they happen. I'm not a religious man, but I'm a man of faith. So everything I've achieved in my life, I've visualized and I've seen it before. I believe in our consciousness, we have a goal attaining system, and you have to have a target to aim towards. So the highlights have always been in my mind first. It started off as a young sporting guy, right?
Yeah.
Where I had highlights in American football, then highlights on television, then, highlights, different things. The most recent highlight is I produced a documentary series on Netflix called Muscles and Mayhem, was about the story of the American Gladiators. So producing, creating, selling, as well as getting my old cast members together and then having it come out ranked number one on Netflix. That was a huge highlight.
That's massive.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Dan. Yeah, well done. Well done.
Oh, thank you. And I don't live in the past, but I remember good moments as a way to keep me positive. So I will go back in my mind to create a positive state, and I'll go back to that win where I looked at the Netflix chart and Muscles and Mayhem was number one, and I call my producing partner. We're like, can you freaking believe this? What? We're number one. So I relive that moment, just in like 1 minute segments, and that gives me confidence to go out and do things I'm unsure about. It teaches me that when I take risks, when I challenge myself, when I put my best work forward, great things can happen. But if I don't take the shots, there is no chance I'm going to win. So I have about five other projects that I'm working on right now. And on each of those, I take time visualizing what it would feel like when it was completed. And I've been doing this since I was 14 years old, when I had my first hypnotherapy session with a gentleman, a hypnotherapist, who rented out. My dad had an office, he had a business, and at night, a hypnotherapist named Roger would rent out his space to see clients. And it was another way for my father also to make money. So I had my first session when I was 14, and it was life-changing. And I know some people get, oh my God, hypnosis, you're going to make me bark like a dog. But no, it's just actually a way to access the subconscious and to implant positive suggestions inside of there so you can go out and achieve them and feel like you've been there. Those are some of the highlights. I have a 12-year-old stepson, and just every day seeing the great things he's doing, it was a highlight. My older son finished law school. That's a highlight.
Awesome.
Gosh darn proud of him. He's living in Portugal now. Cool. There's been a lot of highlights.
Portugal is not too far from Ireland, Dan. So if you're heading over there, there's no excuse to circle back.
And yeah, I thought I was coming out to do the podcast.
I would love to have you over here, man. I would love to have you over. I mean, if you are ever over here, you let me know and I'll show you around. So that's a highlight, Dan. And there's a hell of a lot more. I know there is. Who's somebody in your life that, you'd like to call your, a hero, a role model?
Yeah, I don't have a lot of heroes. It's just this interesting thing where I think I can respect what people have done in their work ethic, but I don't have heroes. I believe everyone's a human being, and we all have the same opportunity. People just have better work ethics and better habits. I can look at, the late, great Kobe Bryant, and not a hero, but someone who I admire their work ethic. I can look at a fantastic actor, who's also a great speaker, like Denzel Washington. But I've met these people. So I don't have that many heroes. I admire people, and I admire people who can overcome tough times. I admire people who can stay positive during turmoil. I admire people who can figure out how to solve something that helps people, or how to solve something to achieve something great that they want. And it's not always tied to, you know, the monetary success. I can really admire a Buddhist monk who's found peace and that transcendence within himself. So I admire a lot of people, but I really don't have any heroes.
Cool. It's a good answer, Dan. And it's good to call out the admiration and work ethic and character and integrity, you know, the things you mentioned. So that's powerful, right? And it, we circle back to the kind of the characteristic traits of, you know, those people and what it takes to be successful. But in terms of, you know, hardship, and you did mention overcoming hardship, I suppose, as part of what you admire in people. Can you kind of tell us a little bit more about your journey, Dan, in terms of maybe some of the hardships you overcame and how you did that? I think that'd be hugely valuable.
Yeah, the hardest thing I've overcome in my life, and it's a work in process still. And just even this last year, 40-some years later, I found a new nuance in how to deal with a traumatic event. So when I was 10 years old, my older brother got into an electrical accident. We were home alone, and he got electrocuted, and he basically died in my arms. And my older brother was my hero. He was my rock. He was my everything. I was so comfortable in his shadow. He was the stronger one, the better one, I thought. And when he died, it was, I had a lot of fear. Mm. Because if he was the stronger one, the better one, the one who I thought should live, and he could die, what was going to happen to me? You know, so if you asked me if I had a hero, it would be him.
Yeah.
You know, I was 10, he was 12. Now you bring it up. And for many years throughout teenage and even in my early 20s, I didn't deal with the grief. I rarely talked about it. I didn't know how to process it at 10 years old. My mother's Japanese, you know, love her, but it's not an emotional, race or they're not emotional people. At least she wasn't. Mm. She's very stiff-lipped. You know, you keep your emotions in. My dad was a, you know, Marine, you know, tough as nails. He drank. So when I was 10, I never had one conversation with him.
Yeah.
Saying, oh, you lost your brother. It's going to be hard. You know, this is what you need to do. I didn't have anybody. So I was very reactive to it. And the one thing I can look back now, if through time, and kind of open up the hood of the car to see what makes it run, was that I put on the size. You know, I got obsessed with being big and being strong and being physical, and I got obsessed with success. You know, and I think it was a way to do two things: the size and the muscle, and, you know, taking roids and being a professional athlete, all that stuff. I like to refer to it as a meat suit. It was just this big meat suit who was all to protect that little scared kid at 10 years old who lost his brother. But I didn't realize that till later on in retrospect, as I, you know, raised my hand and I started to get therapy and started to get help. And, you know, as I went on, I realized that the reason I needed to be seen so much, I needed the applause, was because I had to find out that it was okay, that I was the one who lived and not my older brother. Mm. And when I started to uncover what they call survivor's guilt, it happens you lose somebody, you think, oh my God, it was my fault. What could I have done? What should I have done? They should have lived, not me. When you start to get into it's a survivor's guilt, a lot of times you feel like you have to do, for me, I felt like I had to do too much. Because I kept having to prove that I was the one who deserved to live, because I was living for two.
Yeah,
I was living for him as well. And, you know, for many years in my 20s and my 30s and even in my early 40s, when I have a picture of my brother, my younger brother, on my desk. And when I look at it, I would get emotional and start to weep because there was a sadness.
Mm.
And I was doing some work with a therapist recently, and we just reframed that. And they said, instead of looking at that picture and thinking of what you lost and having those feelings of sadness because it was a trigger. Look at the picture. Oh my God, my brother died. You know, I lived and I'm so sad. I miss him. It became a trigger for became a trigger to feel bad. So instead, we just reframed it and started to think about it. Man, I was lucky to have him for the time I had. You know, wherever we are, wherever we go, I don't know. But, you know, his presence is still with me and he's rooting me on. And the things I do for the love of him and with him. So now when I look at his picture, I feel happy. I feel positive. I feel energized. And it's just, these are just tools that you learn and you pick up when you start to want to evolve as a human being.
Yeah, no. Thanks, Dan, for sharing that. Like, part of me is curious and wants to ask the question, you know, around, like, I'm thinking about if there's people listening in, all right, that have survivor's guilt or that have lost people close to them. Maybe they're young, let's say, you know, or they have kids in that position. But let's just say it as it is, right? There's, like, if you could speak to you, right? So, Dan, you're here right now, right? And if there's a 10-year-old that is in your position, if you could talk to that 10-year-old, what would you share that needs that adult to talk to them, to be there for them? What message would you be with them? Yeah.
Stephen, that's a good question. I've actually done this quite a few times. I talk to myself at 20. I talk to myself at 10. And I talk to my future self as well. You know, my future self comes back and talks to me now. And, you know, it's always a similar conversation. You know, you got this. You can do this. You are loved. You have greatness inside of you. Stay focused. Trust the process. Have faith.
So, Dan, your future self, what does your future self say back to you? What's the message you receive from your future self?
Stay focused. Trust the process. Have faith. You got this. When you trust yourself, you can do amazing things. When you trust yourself, you do the work, you can do amazing things. It all works out. You know, just dare, unlock your greatness by working on hard things, fail faster. You know, life is short. Start doing something that matters. I just remind myself, do stuff that matters. Mm. You know, I'm 59. And when you get to a certain age, and it comes so fast, even, it comes fast.
Yeah, Dan, you're looking good for a 59-year-old.
Yeah, I feel great. Yesterday I was a young bloke like you, just a young guy just sitting there, and you know, had the world in, you know, in front of me. I still have the world in front of me, but you start to think, okay, you know, how many, and it's just, for me, it's not just, about health, lifespan, it's about health span as well, right? Mm-hmm. So I invest so much time and energy into, you know, staying fit and staying healthy and, you know, looking at different like therapeutic peptides, stuff I can take that's on the cutting edge of research to increase the health span along with the lifespan. I have an ice bath at my house. You know, I meditate. There's so many different practices, right? The last like 3-4 years, I've been looking and using in therapeutic peptides like BPC-157, TB-500, some different growth hormones, secretagogues, Ipamorella, and, you know, these different things, CJAK 1295, just to help my system naturally, well, I guess it's not naturally, but help my system increase the things that I had when I was younger so I can, you know, be my most healthiest and fit.
Good stuff, Dan. I think you could write you got to be on Huberman Lab, right? Andrew Huberman and Peter Tia, those guys going to the science of health span and lifespan.
I love those guys, yes. And I was actually doing this before those guys were even had podcasts. But those guys...
But you got to get on that podcast.
Huberman's one of my favorite, though. I like the way he takes big subjects and breaks them down, and he's entertaining. I like that Tia, but he's not quite as riveting as... the information is just as great. But the presentation is just, his delivery is just a little bit, not quite as entertaining, even though entertaining and helpful.
I think entertaining is a good word. Huberman is very enticing in terms of, you can see he just loves it. That what he's sharing, like, is just, he's so excited to share it with the audience, you know, and that's brilliant. But then I suppose a sidestep, like, can you tell us about an average day for you? What that looks like?
Absolutely. So, my creative works, I'm writing a lot now, creating shows, doing that. So what I do, I find for myself, I get up, you know, at a fairly decent hour, 6 a.m.-ish. I have a quiet time. I do this exercise I've been doing for, not a physical exercise. I do an exercise I've been doing for 35 years. And it's called, it was from a book I got when I first started writing by Julia Cameron, called The Morning Pages. No, I forgot the Artist's Way. And the exercise she has you do is The Morning Pages, where you get up unfiltered and you just write for 10 minutes, flow of consciousness. And I like to do that flow of consciousness so I can get down to the good stuff, the stuff that I can get rid of, I can get past and through. Oh, I got to take my son here. I've got this appointment here. I've got that appointment here. And I can get to what's important to me, the good stuff inside of me and into who I am as a human being and a man. So I do that pretty religiously, almost every weekday morning for 10 minutes. And at the bottom of that, I'll schedule. And I usually like to schedule my day. I usually like to work with a mantra. My mantra is I keep focused, I keep moving forward, I trust the process, and I smile. I have to remember the smile part. And I have that written on a 3x5 card.
You know, is it the same every day, Dan? Is that the same? Look, love that.
So this has been the same for like six months.
Love that.
Yeah, this has been the same for 6 months. I keep focused. I keep moving forward. And I think everyone has a different mantra. You know, for a few months when I was struggling with finishing a project, I had another quote that's sitting right under my computer. And it's from a John Steinbeck, East of Eden novel. It says, and now that you don't have to be perfect, you can be good. And now that you don't have to be perfect, you can be good. Because sometimes, and I don't know if you do this too, Steve, is I want things to be so damn good that I struggle over a single word. And it keeps, in the long run, you get the idea, you get the message, you do the best you can do. But that perfectionism sometimes is a way of keeping you out of insecurity of putting things into the world. Mm. You know, it's got to be perfect or they won't like me. It's got to be perfect. They'll think I'm dumb. You know, it's got to be perfect or they won't believe I'm a writer and they'll think I'm a guy who wears spandex on TV.
Are you, and you won't get the adoration and the, you know, that kind of sense of self and self-esteem from other self-esteem.
It's interesting. When I was younger, I had mistaken applause and adoration for love. So the larger the audience, the bigger and the more the audience clapped for me. You know, in a stadium of 74,000 people, they're clapping, good. Or, you know, selling out Madison Square Garden on American Gladiators tour. It was way beyond what I ever thought I was accomplished as a kid. But I kept sucking in that adoration. Say, oh, they love me. This feels so good. It took a long time, you know, to realize that all love for me comes from self-love. And how do you create self-love? For me, I create self-love, number one, by going through and being true to my word, not only to other people, but to myself. I realize, you know, greatness is unlocked if you usually can just do what you say you're going to do. You know, tonight after work, I'm going to go to the gym, you know, or, hey, I want to study for this. I want to get my master's. I want to get my doctorate. Yeah, I really want to do that. I'm going to do that. Or, oh, gosh, in the mornings before work, I want to be an author. I'm going to write a book. I want to do that. If we would just do what we say we're going to do, greatness is there for grabbing. So that's key, you know, for me is doing what I'm saying I'm going to do. And when you follow through for yourself, you respect yourself. You build your self-esteem. And I also believe in, you know, trying new things, having my reach extend beyond my grasp.
Yeah.
I think it's a Browning, right? Have your reach extend beyond your grasp. And I believe as human beings that we all have a greatness inside of us. And I believe as human beings, we are happiest. And it's a paradox. We're happiest when we're striving. Right? We're striving. We have a goal we're trying to achieve because that ties us into purpose. Even if your purpose is your kid. I want to raise the best kids I can. I feel like that's part of my purpose. And if you're striving and you're doing that, I feel like we're the happiest, but it's a paradox because we also have to find moments of stillness. Right? Not only for the psychological aspect, but we also have to find moments of stillness to slow down the nervous system so we can go from the sympathetic nervous system to the parasympathetic nervous system, right? We can get all those other hormones. We can stop the release of cortisol, adrenaline. So it's a paradox. We're happiest when we're striving, when we're going after shit, where we're trying to make ourselves better, we're trying to make the world better, yeah. We got a goal. But we also have to balance that with those moments of stillness and grace for ourselves.
Yeah. No, interesting, Dan. And there's a lot I want to harp on and call back to, but just in that piece around happiness, we're happiest when we're in progress, when we're striving towards something really meaningful and worthy and, you know, our purpose. I would say on the flip side of that, probably unhappiest when we're moving away from that, you know, or moving towards a goal that isn't fulfilling or isn't our purpose or isn't our, you
or
know.
Or Stephen, we're unhappiest when we're doing nothing.
Or nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And if you do nothing, you're moving back. Yeah. I think it's, if you're standing still, you're moving backwards, I think, you know.
I love that.
But to your point, Dan, like, what are some, how do you find moments of stillness? Because I think that's a challenge for people, right? To be present, to be in the moment, to pause, right? To give yourself that space. How do you do that?
I've learned to, when I have short moments, I've learned to go back to breath, to breathing, to do something physical that causes an internal change, right? So there's so many different, you know, there's the box breathing, there's a lot of different techniques, but I get back to stillness a lot through my breath. But I also have a place in my office and my home here where I can meditate or I can take a nap. And it's all the things about naps, meditation, medi nap. Sometimes if I want to sound like I'm doing something more constructive, what are you doing? I'm taking a medi nap.
We do the NSDR and non-sleep deep breaths, those kind of stuff like that as protocols. Huberman Lab has a 10-minute and a 15-minute NSDR. You should actually, if you haven't already, it's brilliant.
I have, yeah, yes. Sometimes I just want to take a nap. It's not non-sleep deep rest. It's 20 minutes of quick sleep.
And can you get down in 20 minutes? Can you switch off different. And get to sleep?
Different. So, but here's what, for me, it has to be timed. I've never taken naps like I'm just going to go lay down and see how long I sleep for. It's very regimented. So it's a reset for me. And there'll be times where I'll listen to something like a guided meditation on Insight Timer app. And they're 17, 19 minutes. And I have the same place I go to every day when I do it in my office. And I'll lay on the ground, put my feet up in an L position. And I'll, you know, get a nice little blanket, a blankie. Big tough guy with his blankie, and it'll be 20 minutes. I get up, I refresh. Other times I have a mat I'll sit on and I'll actually meditate. Different types of meditation, focus, a lot of breathing, awareness. And then in the meditation, I'll also visualize. So it's not only an emptiness, clear my mind meditation, which I do in the beginning. Then I'll start to go back and visualize outcomes that I want to see or, you know, within, I also have a gratitude practice. I used to be better at it, but I would say it's a couple times a week. And I have a 5-minute gratitude journal I use. But I also have a practice, and I got this from this therapist, and it was on Netflix. He was helping this actor, Jonah Hill.
Jonah Hill, yeah, there was a Netflix doc. I didn't watch it, but I know the one that came out, there was a... It's a good,
yeah. It was the guy's name, and it was just their practices and how he's helped Jonah Hill. And what I love most about it was his different twist on a gratitude practice. And that was, he had Jonah Hill say, "Well, we'll do it right now, Stephen. Tell me just three things that you're grateful. Just tell me out loud."
Erica.
Simple things. Yeah.
So my partner Erica, she's an outstanding person. The sun is shining today. I got to spend time out in the sun.
Well, okay, and... sorry. Close your eyes and do this. Close your eyes.
Close my eyes and do it.
I want you to feel as you say it. Go back and I want you to feel. So if you're at home, you can follow along right now. Close your eyes and just think of three simple things that you're grateful for in your life and just say it out loud. Go ahead, Stephen.
Erica, my partner, she's amazing. The sun is shining outside. I got to spend time out. And my work projects with Living Bound. In particular, one client I have, I was with them most of today, called Everseen. They're incredible guys. Alan O'Hurley is the CEO. Great man. Great character. So that's the three things for me right now.
Now, think of a fourth, start to think of a fourth thing, but don't say it or don't think of it and just sit in the feeling of gratitude. So just sit in that warmth feeling of gratitude of about to think of another thing, but you don't think of it, and you just sit in this warmth. It should feel warm through your chest. And that is the feeling of gratitude that permeates your body. Take a deep breath in, feel that gratitude. Open your eyes, come back to me. Yeah. And it was this really interesting short practice.
Yeah, thanks for that.
I'll do that a lot, where I'll sit down and I'll just take a couple of breaths and I'll think of a couple of things I'm grateful for. So with this gratitude practice, Stephen, I do it quite often, you know, throughout the day. And it only takes like 3 or 4 minutes.
And you just notice is that you kind of notice yourself, you have a moment and you do it. Kind of notice.
And sometimes I do it before, right before I go to bed, or if I have, you know, 3 minutes where I can sit down, or 5 minutes on the couch, or I go outside to my front because my office is in my home, and I just sit there and I feel the sun, and I'll just say simple things. Man, I'm so grateful for my dog. Yeah, God, do I love that dog? And I let myself feel it. Yeah, Ricky.
The dog's name.
Ricky and Lucy. We got Ricky and Lucy here.
Yeah, I got two dogs as well. Tommy John and Shelby. I don't know if you ever watched Peaky Blinders, Dan. You probably haven't.
No. It's big. It's been on Netflix.
Killian Murphy. He's the actor, yeah. Yeah. Well, the two characters in Tommy and Shelby. So, anyway.
Perfect. So then I'll sit there and I'll do it. I'll feel it. I'm really grateful for my dog. And it's always simple, easy thing. Oh, I'm grateful at this moment. I can feel the sun on my face. Oh, I'm grateful for, you know, look at the flowers in front of me. And then I'm grateful for. And I get quiet. I don't say anything. And I just let that feeling of gratitude, you know, permeate my body, the warmth, you know, the tingling feeling. Yeah. And there's something about that. I don't know if it releases, you know, oxytocin and these hormones in your body, but you start to feel good. You just take that moment. And, you know, I gave a TED talk quite a few, maybe 5, 6 years ago, and it was talked about collecting those small human moments of truth and beauty. And that is a way to do that. And I believe it's like a bank. You know, you go and you put these things in the bank and it compounds. And eventually you learn that you're the architect of how you want to feel. I don't know if you've ever been to a taping of a television show where you have the guy in the audience. Maybe you've seen it, like when they taped a TV show where you have a guy, an audience wrangler who holds up a sign, clap now. Okay.
Yeah. You see that, Jay.
Okay. Yeah. Boo now. And the place I want to be and I strive to be is that I am in control of how I feel, of how I respond, to never react to what happens to me. Because I think too many times in life, we are that audience and someone's holding a sign at us. But instead of applause, clap, you know, cheer, it's, oh, I cut you off. Now you have to be mad. Oh, I said something to insult you. So now you're going to get, you know, very defensive. Oh, I did something unfair. So my goal is just to protect my inner peace and how I feel. So I can't have little people hold up signs and do things to me to change my inner state. And I think when I talked earlier about transcendence with a Buddhist monk, I think they're at that place where they process everything. And it's a way of being in control. And I think when you're in control of how you feel, I think that's a way where you can have more happiness, have more personal power. You know, when you can master yourself, right? Because it's an inside game. I told my 12-year-old this all the time. He had a soccer game on the pitch. It was a finals, and they had a late night game the night before, and it went down to penalty kicks, and they finally won it on the 8th kick. So they were like, screaming. They had a game the next morning, 2 hours away, and he had to be there at 7 in the morning, so he had to leave at 5 in the morning. And I just said, look, you're not going to get any better physically between now and then. And I said, you know what the challenge is. You're going to be tired. And now that you know that challenge, you have to have the mental strength to overcome that physical deficit. Because right now, son, it's an inside game. And I find mostly in life, things are an inside game. And if you can master that inside game, if you can master your mind, your thoughts, and again, I'll go back on this, Stephen, because I just think it's so crucial. If you would just do what you say you're going to do, your life will change. Not only would you get great results, but you will build your confidence and self-esteem to take on and do things that you never thought you would do. When I came out of high school, there was never one kid from my high school who got a scholarship to pay for college and played football on a Division I level, which is the highest level over here in America. Yeah. There wasn't a kid. I had no role model. I had no example. But I had this belief and I saw it. And I worked my tail off, both physically and psychologically.
Powerful, Dan. And you were a professional athlete, Dan. You were playing Division I football, right? So when, how many, like, so tell us, like, and that, I suppose, it was kind of after that that brought you to Gladiator, right? It was after your sports journey, I suppose, and you can call it Gladiator, it's still part of being sport, being an athlete. But what, can you tell me about that transition of when you went from NFL, you know, Division I athlete to Gladiator ultimately, you know? I know it's a lot of story.
So in university, we Division I is the, over here, it's like, you know, Alabama, it's the big, big colleges. So that's the top flight, top division. From there, I went to the NFL briefly, and then I went and played also in Europe, a professional American football in Italy for Milan. And my NFL career didn't turn out the way I wanted. You know, I wanted to have a long and lengthy career in the NFL. That was my dream. That was my goal. But I didn't yet understand 100% the work ethic that it took. I was that guy who, hey, I'm in the NFL. Let me go drink. Let me go party. Let me go meet girls. Yeah. I didn't have the resources now. There wasn't Instagram, there wasn't YouTube where you got to hear Michael Jordan and Kobe and you know, whoever the guys are, you know, Messi or whoever the heroes are, speak about their process. I didn't quite understand the work ethic. Yuck, I didn't understand that it, once you decide what you want to do and who you want to be, the decisions you have to make become very easy. Right. If you decide you want to be a top performer in any field, there's a path there. It's easy. The decisions are easy, but they're not simple to do. It's hard to get yourself to do them. Right. When you want to be great at something, if you want to be great on the pitch, okay, what do other guys do? What does Messi do? What does Ronaldo do? What are these, the Irish, whoever the Irish heroes are, you know, what do they do? Oh, they're coming in early. Oh, they're getting extra reps in. Oh, they're staying late. Oh, they're not going out drinking and chasing. Oh, they watch their diet. Oh, that's how you do it. Okay. You know, so I didn't have those role models. I was more chasing the fame and the bright lights. And that's why I didn't have a long NFL career, because each level you go up in business, in sport, it gets, as you know, Stephen, it gets harder and harder, and you have, and the margin for error is less and less. You know, the gift of an athlete is, you know, who performs at a high level is, you know what it takes to succeed. The challenge is you have to take those practices that you use to succeed in sport, and like you're doing, and transfer them over to business, because it's the same practices. You know, outwork people, you know, sleep well, have cognitive, replenish the cognitive supply like you would your physical abilities as an athlete. So the path's there. It's just, can you do what it takes, and are you committed enough?
Consistently, isn't it? Consistency, do what it takes, consistently, compound.
Get the reps in. I like to say get the reps in. Get the reps in. Like, I'm switching from, you know, writing for films to TV, and I haven't written a lot of TV, and it's daunting. And the reason I'm switching more to writing scripted television is because stuff gets made. Feature films, I've had so many, they're just in development.
Yeah,
where television, it feels more accessible. And with television, there's also a writing room where there's camaraderie, where you're sitting in a room with 6-7 other writers breaking story. And I come from a team.
Ooh.
I like being a team. I like being part of a team.
Being in a team, yeah. That energy you get, right, in collaboration, it's a magic thing, isn't it?
Right, where we're film and books, you're more writing by yourself or with a partner, but there's not a team. And with TV, they're making so much great TV now with the different streamers. It's almost unfair. It's almost unfair that there's that much TV. So I'm making a push there. But I have to, I tell myself the same things. Look, get the reps in. Get the reps in. And it's the same practice I mentally, you know, I did when I was 16 years old on the football field. The same practices I did with, you know, American Gladiators, right? So how do you be good? How do you go and get the extra training? How do you outwork people?
And obviously, like, looking at American Gladiator and the journey you've been on, and obviously Muscles and Mayhem, incredible documentary about the journey to some point. What was the wildest experience as a gladiator? What was the wildest experience as a gladiator?
Steve, I think I alluded upon it earlier. The wildest experience as a gladiator was selling out Madison Square Garden in a live show. So in America, the premier arena is Madison Square Garden. It's where they have the biggest boxing matches. It's the biggest sporting events, the biggest concerts. And our live tour went there. And I walked out onto the arena floor, and there were 16,000 people just saying, Nitro, Nitro, Nitro. And I ran out there, and they all jumped to their feet, and that, for that moment in time, it lit a lot of empty places that loomed large inside of me. And it was quite a time. And there were other times where you realize, you know, that you're kind of famous, which is interesting, where, you know, you go from looking at the world to having the world look at you. And it's an interesting thing, because in your mind, you're just the same dude. You're the same person.
Yeah.
Just a dude, you know, hanging out, and, you know, I still have the same friends, and, you know, why are you coming up to me? It's just this odd feeling of when that happens. And it can be intoxicating. It can be intoxicating.
Yeah.
You know, because if that's what fulfills you, when that goes away, you're left with nothing, right? If that's all you got. Yeah. And, you know, that's a process too. But look, American Gladiators, and even the British Gladiators, I know Hunter, and I spoke to Wolf not too long ago, and Jet, I'm friends with them, because we actually came over to the international shows. We went to Birmingham and we competed with those guys. So I've become friends with them over the years. And the British Gladiators, was it big in Ireland as well?
It was, yeah. Yours is probably bigger, I'd say. Dan, the American Gladiators were bigger than the British ones, I think, globally, I would say, you know. Mm. But yeah, the names, like Hunter and the guys now, I definitely, I'm 35, right? So I was probably a little bit young, but I remember it. I remember
it
clear.
Wolf as well. Yeah, so it was a raucous time, you know, full of youth, bravado and energy.
What was the biggest lesson you took away from that time, that period?
That's a good question. I don't know what the biggest lesson would be. I've never really thought about it in those terms. If I look back and I just say, life is so unexpected.
Unexpected, yeah.
Unexpected, just strange shit happens that you couldn't have planned for. And if you're prepared in that moment, you'll succeed. So after football, my football career ended. I moved up to Hollywood, and it wasn't to be an actor. I had no training. To be a thespian, I had no training. I moved up there because there was an American football show on HBO, and they were looking for football players to be background workers, extras. And I just said, that sounds cool to me. You know, I'm 20 to 23 years old. I've got a little money in my pocket from the NFL. Let's go up there. And that was the same time that Schwarzenegger and Stallone and Van Damme and these guys who weren't actors, but who had the physique, who became big stars. Yeah. So all of a sudden it was this pathway, like, oh, look, I don't have all this, you know, theater training, but I kind of look like those guys a little bit, you know, Schwarzenegger, Arnold, and it, those guys, I were role models in that sense where they showed that there was a path forward. And so I moved to LA on a whim, and then I saw those guys. And I said, hey, maybe I can do that. But there was no such thing as the American Gladiator. So it wasn't like I planned on that. It was just an audition. I went up there and gave it my all and just happened to get this job on this new first reality show that would probably change the face of TV forever.
Yeah. First reality TV show, ultimately. And look at how many reality TV shows have been produced ever since, you know. So
Steve, you have to be so be ready. Be ready. You never know when the opportunity is going to come. Be ready. You know, just do what you feel like you can do and just prepare and be ready, be ready, be ready, because it's going to come. It is going to come. Even like the documentary series, you know, I'd written a book, Gladiator, True Story of Roids, Rage and Redemption, like 10, 12 years before. And just out of the blue, because I did the work, because I took the risk, because I wrote something. And even when I wrote that book, Steven, no one was saying, hey, Dan, you know, you should write a book. We really want your book. I said, you know what? I have something to say. I got a story to tell.
Yeah.
I got a story to tell about this.
Powerful, Dan. That's powerful, Dan.
And so I went and wrote the book. No one was asking. I had to go sell it. It wasn't like, you know, here's this big offer, go write this book. I had to do the work. I had to write a 75-page book proposal, 3 sample chapters. It was something I had never done before. And I went out and I got coaching. I brought in an expert to kind of help guide me. But and then I took that risk and I sold it. And, you know, it was quite a great payday. And that book that nobody wanted, that nobody asked for, that I wrote because I believed I could put something good out into the world, that was the basis for Netflix. Someone read that book and they said, hey, I think, you know, based upon your story, you know, the story of, you know, losing your older brother, the story of being told that big boys don't cry, you know, that you need to be tough and man, and eventually learning that as you grew up and you became a whole human being, that big boys don't cry, but men do.
That
is something more than people in spandex. And we think there's a documentary series here. Can you come up with an idea and break it down to 6 episodes? So things don't always happen when you want them to happen, but you follow your intuition, you follow your gut, and you just put things out and you be brave and you know, the universe has a way. I know it sounds very esoteric. The universe has a way of coming in and, you know, the muse coming in and helping those who dare to risk and dare to be great.
Yeah. No, from my experience in life, I tend to feel the same way from my experience. And I know that, you know, just being with other people and seeing their journeys, it seems to work out that way. You know, when you put the work in with the right intention, you know, be ready because it's coming. Just it might not come, might not come tomorrow, but it might come at a time and it'll come at the right time. And I think then that line, right, I remember, because I did watch Muscles of Mayhem and it was really, really good. That line, I remember it. One of the most impactful things I took away was that, you know, big boys don't cry, but men do, you know, that was something. I think that line was, you know, that was something. I think probably a lot of men, you know, I would say I needed to hear that.
Well, it seemed to resonate with a lot of men. So the way that line, the way that originated is when I was 5 years old, and my parents got divorced and my dad got custody of my older brother and I, and my mom got custody of my sister, and my dad took us away from my mother. And I remember being on the plane on the tarmac, and I'm looking through the window back in those days when you could have people out there on the tarmac. I can see my mom, you know, and I'm 5 and she's just out there and she's crying and she's got her arms out to my older brother and I. And I still get emotional when I think about it. And I just look at her and you're taking me from my mom. And I just remember I was just crying uncontrollably. You know, I'm just weeping and they couldn't get me to stop crying on the plane. And there was a gentleman behind me who said, hey, he said, let me see your muscle. And this is, again, I'm crying and I'm 5 and I'm like, what? But I listened to him and I flexed my muscle and up popped this little butt of a muscle. And he looked at me and he said, look, you're a big boy and big boys don't cry. And I stopped crying. And I would not allow myself to cry. I didn't allow myself to cry when my brother died, because I wanted to be a big boy. You know, I wanted to be strong. Yeah. And big boys don't cry. And it wasn't until that I got, you know, tremendous success on the American Gladiators. I had more than I ever thought I would. I had my own action figure. We had sold out Madison Square Garden. I was, you know, doing all those things you think, you know, some people would do, dating models, partying like a rock star, doing drugs. And I started to wake up in the mornings. Well, I remember one particular morning where I woke up, you know, after an all-night bender, coke, cane, ecstasy, a bunch of other shit that's just as illegal that I can't ever remember. And I'm lying on the floor and I have spit dribbling on my mouth and I was crying. And I said, wow, I have everything I want in my life. And here I am in the morning, hungover, crying. I had not cried since I was 5 years old.
So how old were you then?
I was 24.
So that's
25 years old. 20 years I had not cried.
Yeah.
And I said, something's wrong. I said, something's wrong if I have everything and that this is going on. It happened a few more times, and that was the impetus to go get therapy, which back then, you know, was a hard thing to do because, you know, as a big, strong, tough guy, you know, in the early 90s, you just didn't go to therapy. But the ability to raise my hand back then, Stephen, and to say, look, something's wrong, I need help. And then to spend the next, you know, 25 years unpacking that and, you know, understanding the trauma, understanding the grief, and you know, moving forward to become a whole person. And then eventually, you know, on the Gladiators, I knew for me as a human being to live, for Danny Lee Clark to live, that Nitro had to die. That part of me had to die in a way, who was chasing adulation, fame, who was hedonistic. Yeah. That part of me had to die. So instead of having that dopamine momentary hit, which was never enough of whatever I was doing, in order for me to find fulfillment, to find wholeness, I had to change. And I knew if I did not change, that I'd probably die just from the shit I was doing, you know? And speaking to that, my father is someone who never raised his hand and dealt with the grief and the trauma of my older brother dying. And he died of a drug overdose at, what is it, 58, 57? But he, you know, alcoholic, then it got to cocaine, then it got to opioids. He was someone who didn't deal with the grief. And I think that's what can happen, you know, if you don't deal with that trauma, that grief, that sadness, whatever it is inside of you.
Yeah.
And the whole idea that I did raise my hand, that I did get help, that I did come to the understanding that big boys don't cry, that men do, and I allowed myself that grace and vulnerability, is the whole reason I'm here today.
Yeah. And that's inspiring, to be honest. And a lot of it rings true for me too, I suppose. I playing on a big stage with hurling, you know, in Ireland, you're playing in front of 80,000 people and you get a huge amount of adoration for that. And you can begin to chase that for your own validation, and you know, you can get your identity wrapped up in that as well. Like for you to say that Nitro had to die for Danny Clark to move forward in life and to live. Some, you know, athletes find it hard to transition from being an athlete to being fully human, basically, and to be yourself.
I think it's changing, and I think it's good. There's a lot of education. There's a lot of people coming out and speaking that, you know, you can hold both. You can be this tough, invincible guy who kicks ass and smashes your opponent and wins, but at the same time have a humanity to you and a wholeness. Yeah. They're not mutually exclusive anymore. You know, and I think... a lot of the work I like to put out into the world is to, for men, young men, especially, to handle that duality.
Yeah.
You know, that it's okay to have emotions. Emotions are not weak. Weakness, to me, again, it goes back to the simple thing. Weakness is not doing what you say you're going to do and what you want to do. That's weakness. Weakness of your volition to not follow through and show up for yourself. Weakness is like, oh God, you know, I'm hurting right now and I'm sad. That's not weakness. That's humanness. And yeah. Distinguishing between those two, I think, is really, really a crucial element, because that machismo from that earlier era is still really prevalent today. But again, it's not totally woke, where, you know, I still believe there's a masculinity and a femininity, and either sex can have both. But I still believe that, you know, nature intended us to be different because we have different hormones, right? You know, the men with the testosterone, the female have a little testosterone, but we're supposed to be different and complement each other. And again, the idea that you can still be tough and strong and kick ass and, you know, whatever your thing is, both men and women, but you can also, on the other hand, hold that softness, that love, that kindness, that vulnerability.
Thanks, Dan. And you know, you shared earlier on kind of putting your hand up and asking for help and seeking help, and therapy being a huge part of what helped you to deal with the sadness. You know, in terms of that sadness, do you still get sad today?
Yeah, you know, I just got sad when I talked about my mother and being a little boy and being taken from my mom. I got sad. You know, my stepfather's, you know, for 30 years, he's in the hospital. He's sick. I get sad about that. There was an article in the paper about some little baby, 2 years old, whose mom went on a 10-day vacation.
Saw that. And fuck it, that's very sad. That broke my heart as well. Yeah, how do you deal with that then? That's the question I have. Is like, how do you deal with that?
Well, just like I am now. I read that and I got emotional. I felt my eyes like water with tears, and you know, like they are, like just now, I just feel like a little emotion surge through me, and I just let it course through me. I let it course through me, and I am thankful for my humanness, not for my male or masculine or femininity. I'm thankful for my humanness that I can feel, because that's what separates us, right, from everything. Mm-hmm. We can feel. We have the ability to feel. Life without feeling is a life not worth living to me. So again, to be very specific, Stephen, so when I feel the sadness about that story about the mom went on vacation and left her 10-year-old home alone, or 2-year-old home alone, and she died. For 10 days. I feel it, sadness come up in me. I feel my eyes fill with water, and I let it pass through me. I sit there. I don't say, oh, I can't feel sad. I got to be strong. I got to be tough. You know, big boys don't cry. I just let it feel. And then I'm thankful to have that humanness. Does that make sense? And I don't feel weak. I don't feel weak. I feel very human. And it's been so interesting to me on this journey, you know, last 10, 15 years, and especially with the docuseries where I was very open and vulnerable, where how many people, both men and women, reached out and said, like you said, I needed to hear that. I'm raising two young men, 18 and 20 years old. I had them watch this. So thank you for saying that, so they can understand, you know, that it's okay as a big, strong, tough guy to have feelings, to admit you're afraid, to be weak. Not to be weak, that's unfair, but to be human.
Yeah.
Which we used to think was weakness.
Question, Dan. I know we're pushing on time. Even though you have a few questions, right? But and I've had a lot more than a few questions, but definitely hoping to ask a few. But my sense around when I hear about that story about the mother that went on vacation and other things is to try and do something about it. How can I help? You know, sometimes you can't do anything, or you know, there's always something potentially you could do, but what impact can I have? It could be very little, subtle. But let's take, for example, what's going on with Russia, what's going on with Ukraine, over in Gaza, in these places. And oftentimes I think about it, and it would give me that little, you know, bit of sadness. And there's other things in life as well that would do that for me. Like, how do you, you know, when you feel it, but is there at times when there's probably something more you need to do, or that doesn't help? The saddest thing,
you know, Stephen, I still grapple with that.
Yeah,
I'm human and I grapple. Yeah. There's no easy answers to, you know, what's going on in Israel There's no easy answers to what's going on, like you said, in Russia, and I grapple. I usually find the cause that I believe, and then I donate to it. I yep. donate money to it. Yeah, and I grapple with how to go on, and it feels sometimes self-serving and selfish to go on after the things I want to do and want to put in the world, which seems so small compared to those larger things, right? But I feel the way we contribute as human beings is to, you know, we have a voice, we have a platform, to continue to use that platform to perpetuate the things that we believe in,
yeah.
right? And find our lane. You know, for me, it's really, you know, telling human stories about, now it's about men who might not be likable in some ways, or who are hard men who have something that happened to them that have to rise up and overcome and become somebody different. I'm working on a couple different movies like that. And I'm attracted to those stories about very masculine men who get broken and yeah. have to yeah. start to see the world in a different way in order to survive and to be find happiness or whatever their end goal is. I'm attracted to, you know, those kind of human stories because I feel like it's another way to, you know, perpetuate, you know, my story. And, you know, I don't have all the answers. I still exploring, but I feel like I at a place the last, you know, 10 years where I'm a pretty fulfilled guy. You know, I don't feel empty by not achieving the lofty goals that I had.
Yeah.
Right. You know, win an Oscar. You know, have my own.
You never know, Dan. You never know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's it's a work in progress, you know, by not having my own airplane by the time I'm this age, by not having 17 houses, you know, all that stuff that, you know, when I was young, I thought I wanted. And I found, you know, peace with that. And it's not settling. It's I found other ways to fulfill myself, you know, simple moments of human beauty and truth. I found what it really feels like to be a father and how rewarding that is you know, with my stepson, which when, you know, my son didn't get the best version of me, I was 22 years old. I was doing Gladiators.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I feel guilt about that. I feel guilt about that, that I'm able to give this son so much, my stepson so much more as a man and a human being than I was.
How do you forgive yourself, Dan? How do you forgive yourself? Sorry to jump in, but how do you deal with that guilt?
Positive self-talk. Yeah, it's just self-talk. I said, look, I did what I could. I did the best I could with the tools I had. I still did good, but I could have gotten better in those areas, and I'm going to do it now. I'm not going to lead with intimidation and anger. I'm going to coach him and teach him like I would have wanted to be coached when I was 12 years old, which is, you know, part of it's firm, but it's also goal setting and mapping behavior that you want to see from them. Also leading with a lot of love, positivity, encouragement. And I did that with my son. I just was a lot more, I led a lot with intimidation. You better, you know, and I regret that. I learned from my dad, you call me yes, sir. If you don't, you're going to pick yourself up off the ground. You know, you're going to be tasting, my belt or my backhand. I think you just learn to give yourself grace. You know, if not, how do you continue?
Yeah,
you know, you learn to give yourself grace, and I think self-love goes a long way. And again, I build self-love by doing what I'm saying I'm going to do, not only in work, but as a human being, you know, exercise, as a partner to my son, stepson's mother, to my friends, showing up. And I'm such a big believer in positivity. I when I see people, I go to the supermarket. I smile. I say hi. I talk to people. My Kim, my partner, thinks I'm like nuts. You talk to everybody. You're just. I said, I just like I like it. I like interacting. Yeah. I like sharing that moment of positivity. You know, in my TED talk, I talk about that. How, you know, those moments of positivity create a ripple effect.
Yeah, we put that TED talk in the show notes. Dan, I listened to it. It's amazing. It's and it, By the way, an incredible amount of views on it as well. I think you're near a million, right? Isn't it?
It's somewhere up there. I haven't looked at it recently, but
I put it in the show notes.
So the idea, and I know this sounds touchy, feely, goody. Oh, you know, there's, like we talked about, how do you do this in the face of the wars and the tragedies and the people starving every day? You know, it sounds so minuscule, unimportant, but you really can create a ripple effect of positivity. I'm kind to somebody at the store. I open the door for somebody. Oh, yeah, here. I grab something up top for somebody off of a shelf. Or I'm getting on a plane. I see someone struggling to put their luggage up. And I got that for you. I help them. They smile. And they say, oh, my God, thank you.
Yeah.
Now they go sit down next to somebody. They're beaming. They're like, oh, that was so nice. You know, people aren't nice anymore.
Love it.
You know, and then they go. And then that goodness, that burst of positivity wears off on that next person next to them. They call their kid. They're like, oh, they call it for a friend. No, this guy was really positive. Oh, that's sweet. And that wears off and that rubs off on the next person. So by doing these small little acts of human kindness, something we need in this world where everybody is at me, or they're buried in their damn phones.
That's sad as well, isn't it?
And I fight it. And I fight it with my 12-year-old too. You're buried in that phone. You ever go? I travel a lot. You know, I go speak and I do stuff. And I go to the airport. Everybody is just so buried in the phone. There is no human contact. There is no human connection. And that's why I go out of my way to make that connection. Because I think that's what's, you know, troubling a lot of people. Anyway.
Yeah, you're right, Dan. And it's human nature, right? It's human evolution. It's what we all came from, is to be connected, be part of a tribe, to grow with that and contribute and bring value. And that's inherent in all of us as humans, is we still thrive and strive for that. That's when we're at our best. That's when life is at its best, is when we have that connection, right? And a part of something great. And to you, like, to go back into writing TV series and being in the room with people, right? Being part of that tribe rather than writing in isolation, I think that's a special thing. Dan, conscious of time for you, tell me about what's next for you. And I know you've got a great book as well. Which, fuck dying, I know that book you have. I put that in the show notes, right? But if you wanted to share a quick insight into that as well, that might be great. And I'd love to look at maybe what's next for you as well and wrap up then. But tell us more about, can you give us an insight into the book?
The second book was F Dying, How Cheating Death Kicked My Ass Into Living. I'll have to read the title.
I see it there, yeah.
How Cheating Death Kicked My Ass Into Loving, Learning, and Living My Best Life. I don't know if that's the best title, but F Dying. I had a heart attack. Faced my mortality, and it really taught me how to live. So a lot of this stuff comes from that deep exploration of facing your mortality, thinking you have a limited time left, and what did I learn in that moment? And a lot of the stuff that we talked about earlier, Stephen, is in the book, different best practices to find fulfillment and happiness now, and not to have a life-threatening, calamity.
How do you
do that? Because no one teaches us that.
Yeah.
Right? No one teaches us that. And that this book is everything I learned. And I wrote that book, F Dying, just as a way to remember. Because, a lot of times, like, let's say you get a speeding ticket. You guys have speeding tickets in Ireland?
Oh, we do. What? Plenty of those, yeah.
Yeah, what happens when you get a speeding ticket? What do you tell yourself, Stephen?
I'm cool with that, I suppose. It is what it is. I'm easy going with that stuff, Dan. I kind of have a good mindset around.
But don't you say, I'm not going to speed again?
Not really. I kind of say, look, I'll take my chances. Like, you get a speeding ticket here, Dan, for going 5 kilometers over the actual, you get unlucky, you get, you know. But that's what a lot of people would say, yeah.
I think most people, like, I'm speeding, and I said, oh, gosh, I'm not going to speed again. Yeah, I hate this ticket. It's a lot of money. My car insurance goes up. This is terrible. I'm not going to speed anymore.
Yeah.
And for like a week, you're following that speed limit to the T. A couple of weeks go by, you're creeping up, and then within a month or 6 weeks, you're just ripping down the road again. You're like,
faster than ever before.
Get that? Yeah, right. Yeah, you
faster than ever before.
And so, you know, when I thought I was going to die, all these ideas and thoughts came up to me, and I was sure how I wanted to rebuild my life and live. And I started keep researching, reading more and more, but I found that as more time went by, it was kind of like that speeding ticket. I was like, you know, I was back to, you know, that guy who was chasing success, hungry for it even before I finished the last chewing and digesting the last bite. I was off to the next thing.
Yeah.
And so I wrote the book and these ideas as a way for me to remember how to live a happy and fulfilled life. And then I showed it to a few friends and shared it, like, oh my God, Danny, these are great. You should write another book and share these with the world. So that's what the F dying is.
Brilliant. We'll put that in the show notes down. And, you know, it's a, no doubt it's an incredible book. Like, so fair play for writing that. And congratulations again for writing another book. Dan, what's next for you? So what's the next 5 years, 2 years? What does that look like?
Let's continue to, you know, just go after things I believe in. You know, put good projects into the world. I've got a couple movies I'm working on. As a writer, going out and, you know, I speak quite regularly. So for me, it's just continuing to do these things, being clear on my mission, keeping focused, keeping moving forward, and trusting the process.
That's trust the process, right? That's something that's the title for the episode, right? Trust the process. But Dan, in closing, right, do you have any last message to share? Anything you want to, you know, take a moment to call out again?
Thank you for the work, Stephen, that you're putting out into the world. Thank you for inviting me on all the way across the pond. And thank you for giving me this platform to speak and to hopefully put some positivity out into and some, not only positivity, but some best practices and thought patterns and tools that are applicable out into the world so people can use and learn from, you know, the things I've dedicated my life to learning. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Thank you, Dan, for coming on. Right. I think the reason I wanted you to come onto the show is because of your character, who you are, your mission, your purpose, your desire and a selfless nature of wanting to give back, wanting to be a positive light, and not wanting, but actually being that, right? So, and the journey you've been on, right? You've been through a lot and you're standing tall, and that you should be proud of. And, you know, I really want to just thank you so much for coming on, man.
Hey, the best is ahead, my friend.
That's it, guys, for another episode. And really, really lucky to have spoken with Dan, to connect with him. And, you know, obviously I learn a hell of a lot from these conversations. I'm really lucky, and I hope you learn as well. And I always say that learning is one thing, but taking action is a whole different ballgame. So please take action. One simple action arising out of what you learn from the podcast. That would be that would lead to massive momentum in your life in a positive way. And maybe one action you could do is you could maybe share the podcast with someone who you feel would benefit from it. Leave a review, give a rating, you know, whatever it is that would help the podcast, because ultimately, you know, I get to do this as a result of you getting to support me and you supporting this. So I really appreciate it, everybody. So thank you very much for being here. And look, I look forward to bringing more conversations like this to you, and I look forward to connecting with you along the way as well. So thank you very much, guys. And look, have a good day, good week, good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever it is for you. Listen, I'm rooting for you, and I hope you have a great day.